Okay. But I hope you can see it, and I hope you can enjoy it, and you can see each other's chats.
Aloha,
green and one red for the porch. It sounds like a new thing for me because I don't know.
Welcome to Moe's Paisley Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I understood what they were saying. You know, kid of ours is there's something weird or wrong about him. And so I said, okay, well, they would speak in French. And I would just, to me, it just sounded like humma, 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 you know, or parlez long. Robert Benchley wrote a really funny article about French in which he said everything sounded like ong. And it's a pretty funny essay. And Benchley was a funny guy. At least to me, he was funny. He was a contemporary of Thurber. And he wrote back in the 20s. And he was in movies, too, back in that period of time. 30s, 40s. He was in talkies. And funny guy. Funny stuff. At least I thought so. Very dry stuff. Although his movies were almost slapsticky, but not quite. Not quite. If you've never read any James Thurber, you might not be amused. One might think he was kind of a misogynist. I think he might have been. He was a contemporary of Dorothy Parker, and he was a member of the Algonquians in New York. And I found him quite humorous. As a matter of fact, long time ago, when I was first married, and I'm not going to get into the drama of it, but I was kind of stranded, and I was alone. I say "and" a lot today. Maybe I say that all the time, but it must be something going on. It's maybe a little better than a stutter, but not a whole lot. So, I was at the campus bookstore, getting ready to move back to Colorado and leave my family. I'd never been away from my family. I'd gotten married, and we'd lived on the other side of campus, away from my family. And it was obvious to me that I was getting ready to move to Colorado, and I probably would never see my family in that way as a family again. And I was depressed about it. My future ex-wife had already moved to Colorado. Things were tense. Didn't realize how tense they would become. No, I did not. But two wonderful children later, it would take some time to really boil over the cauldron, so to speak. But, oh, my kids. Oh, do I love my kids. They love me. That's for sure. But I went down to the campus bookstore and I bought Thurber. Had never read much Thurber before except in school where they said, "Class, what do you think of this? What does this mean?" You know, the catbird seat and that sort of thing. And I started I bought the daring middle-aged man on the flying trapeze. And I read two or three stories and was just screaming with laughter. Screaming with laughter. His sarcasm, his biting wit. And then I went the next day, because I had a little extra money, and bought The War Between Men and Women. And I will admit, I probably was in the right mood for that, seeing as how I had been completely abandoned and left with a couple of ultimatums. And I will say that that was what kind of got me through. You know, was reading some funny stuff. Funny stuff. Didn't have to be Thurber, I imagine. I also read P.G. Woodhouse. Wooster and Jeeves. Wooster and Jeeves. There was one line in there that left me crying. I was just laughing so hard, I was literally crying. I was crying so hard at 2 a.m. Literally just in tears. And then I woke up the whole house. They thought I was actually crying. You know, "Oh, poor Moe, he's so upset." But I'm in my bed reading Bertie Wooster, who's just this idiot. If you've never read any Wooster and Jeeves, it's worth the time to read about this fop, this British fop and his butler Jeeves, who basically, you know, keeps him from, you know, putting his head into a pencil sharpener and grinding it away. It's just hysterical stuff. But he talks about how, you know, Wooster, it was a line about how a salmon was staring at him as if he was going to write an editorial to the Times. You know, he was so upset with him. But you have to read it. Doesn't translate well. But it just, I was in the right mood. I needed something to boost my spirits. And there are some times when things happen to come along to boost your spirits. And the universe has a way of sometimes making those things happen. You know, sometimes it's a note you might get in the email. Sometimes it's this or sometimes it's that. When I was in school, finals, as a matter of fact, boy, if you've never been on a campus during finals week, you should do it sometime. I worked at the first Kinko's in Louisiana. It was on LSU campus. And I bugged these guys. They were from Santa Barbara, which is where Kinko's got its start. A guy named Paul, and he was Lebanese. And his name was Kinko because of his hair, which was kinky. And these two guys who knew him started up, actually three guys. They came down. They were pounding nails into boards. And they had these two IBM Copier 2s, which were real workhorses. And I said, what are you guys doing? They said, we're starting a copying business. I said, Kinko's, huh? And I was a student. And I said, would you guys hire me? Because I really wanted a job. And they said, no, we're not going to hire you. I said, come on, man. You guys need someone to work. I said, no, we've got it in hand. I said, look, I'm not from around here. I'm from Colorado. You guys really should consider hiring me. And I was really getting on their nerves because every time I would walk by, I would say, you guys need some help. So eventually it turned out they did need help and they hired me. So I was the first person in Louisiana ever hired by Kinko's, which was their first ones in the South. And Paul would call up every day and ask for these numbers. He was real hyper. And of course he became a billionaire at some point. So that's my brush with greatness. But it was quite an operation. And so anyone who needed a copy, and it was right off of campus. And people would come in during finals week, and especially we had a law school, and these lawyers would come in, these future lawyers, and they would be so uptight, I would think to myself, if I touch one of them, they'll shatter into a billion pieces. And I would see grown men and women, well, you know, grown in their 20s, and they would be weeping. The guys, they'd be crying because they were so uptight. I need this by this afternoon. And I'd say, I can't. You know, I can't. Look at all these jobs I have ahead of you. I'll pay you $100. I said, I can't. Sorry. And they'd start crying. And I'd say, oh, calm down, man. You know. And tensions. So here it was. It was a finals week. And I said, man, I got to get out from studying because I was a history major. And historians, you know, history teachers are whip snappers. They want things like term papers, but I never did a term paper in college because I was a cartoonist. So I cartooned my way through college. And I said, I got to get out. So I went, strolled onto campus, and Singing in the Rain was playing, and I'd never seen it. And I said, well, it's 50 cents. I basically was able to scrape together 50 cents as a, because it was my coffee money. And I said, well, I'll go without coffee to see a movie. And I'm a Donald O'Connor fan from way back. And I'd never seen it, and the place was packed. Because you could basically show a movie about a rock, you know, sitting on a piece of pavement for 2 hours. And during finals week, you know, I was amazed I could get in. And I sat next to a friend of mine who also happened to be there. And it was the most entertained I've ever been in my life. It's a great movie, number one. So it's one of the finest movies I've ever seen, Singing in the Rain. If you've never seen Singing in the Rain, oh my goodness. Singing in the Rain is easily one of the best movies ever made. Stanley Donen directed it. All the songs are from the past, before Singing in the Rain was made, including the song Singing in the Rain. But it's just an incredible bit of entertainment. And I still think Donald O'Connor steals the whole movie. Poor Debbie Reynolds, she was 16 years old and tortured throughout the entire movie. When you read about the making of the movie, you know, and the big famous guy. I'll think of it. It's not Gene Reynolds. That's Debbie Reynolds. Oh, my God. Old. I'm getting old. I got a birthday in a couple of months. I'll be 71. So, the big dancer guy. I know you know it. You know, you're screaming it out at your radio. It'll hit me. This is part of it. I have these little, these little bubbles that go, they go literally. That's what they do. They go. They just pop. And, God, doesn't matter. But he kissed her. He gave her a big French kiss at one point that was not wanted, and that disgusted her, you know. But at least that's the story. But he also, I guess, invented a mashed potato sandwich that was delicious. Gene Kelly. Isn't that funny? That's what, a little bit of trivia, that's what gave me his name. Gene Kelly. Oh my God, how do you forget that? But it was Fred Astaire who really talked her in off the ledge. She was hiding under a piano weeping, and he came in and said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Oh, this is..." And he said, "Come on out from there, you know. Empty the blood out of your shoes, and we'll get you going again." But what a movie. If you've never seen it, make a point of it. Isn't that funny? One of my other favorite movies is The Music Man. But I saw that movie, and the audience was so appreciative that at one point, after the make 'em laugh bit, if you've never seen that, you should watch it. After the make 'em laugh bit, the audience, a bunch of students, like completely caffeined out of their mind, stressed out of their mind, they stood up and gave the movie a standing ovation to the point where the projectionist had to stop the movie. He rewound it. Well, you know, he did whatever he did, and he played it again. It was unbelievable. Moments like that stick with you for the rest of your life, you know. When people do things that give you relief in life, how do you get those things? You know, what is it about that? What is it about that that makes it so worthwhile? What is it that makes it so wonderful? There are times when moments like that stick with you, and they stick with you forever, and the universe delivers them. Sometimes people deliver them. Sometimes people don't even know that they're able to really do that for you. We had to run an errand. We're out running an errand, and this guy in this little car, we were stopped, and this guy in this little car, far away from us, goes zipping around another car, honking his horn, and giving the one finger salute. You know, the fickle finger of fate award to somebody. And I thought, man, relax. Take it easy, buddy. What in the world is so important to you that you are so angry? And I realize people are just really angry right now. And I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not overjoyed at a lot of the things going on in the world. Are you? Aren't there things going on right now that maybe have you, you know, pretty torqued? I'm pretty torqued. Peter Tork isn't with us anymore. Now, for those of you who don't know who Peter Tork is, he was one of the Monkees, which I think is an underrated group. They were pretty darn good. Even though they didn't write all their music in the beginning, they performed it pretty darn well. They didn't produce it in the beginning. Eventually, they did their own stuff, and I think they were just fine. I enjoyed it. I watched the Monkees twice a week, every week, as kids in my age bracket did. We enjoyed the Monkees. Not everyone did. But I liked them. They were funny. They were irreverent. And they were sarcastic, which kind of, you know, they were older than I was. And I was irreverent, and I was sarcastic. That was kind of the hallmark of the baby boomers, by the way. We were sarcastic, and we thought we were funny. We still think we're funny. That's the nice thing about it. But, yeah. And we wanted a worldwide experience. And we didn't like the idea that things were going on we didn't know about, which is why I took French. Because my parents were talking behind my back, and they were doing it a lot. And I think they were kind of worried about me, because I was a little bit weird little kid. I'd already taken a deck of cards and drawn strange symbols on them and started just looking at them, and I'd lay them out, and I'd see stories. Stories about things that were going to happen, which often did happen. I kind of began to see a pattern of this'n and that'n and whatever'n. And it was odd. It was odd that it came about, and that I could see those patterns and understand just exactly how things began to work out. And then I got into Tarot. I was about 13. I was actually 10 when I ordered my first Tarot deck, 11 when I got them, and boy, oh boy, I didn't understand hide nor hair of it, because it was a deck that was, well, it was the Brotherhood of Light deck, if you know the deck. It's okay. C.Z. Zane's deck. And I was fascinated because it was kind of pseudo-Egyptian, but not really, you know what I mean. But good enough. Got me started. And then I got a very traditional gaming deck, Swiss gaming deck, and that was hard to decipher. Got a book along with it from the campus shop on the corner of College and Laurel Streets in Fort Collins. Back around 1967, which was things were happening. Boy, was that a happening year. I got it in the summer of love. And a little town of mine was actually a happening time. It was a college town. There was a lot going on. Yepper. Wow, it was a time. It was a good time to be alive. It was a strange time. But it felt good. It felt restrictive. I don't care who you were, where you were. It felt restrictive. And I think it was supposed to feel restrictive. It was supposed to feel like you were not allowed to be who you were. You were supposed to feel like someone was trying to hold you back. You were supposed to feel like someone was keeping you from doing what you were meant to do. And that is why things turned out the way they did. That is why things happened the way they did. I talked about hair last week. Not my hair. Although my hair, I haven't had a haircut in almost 9 months. So it's getting long. And I like it. It's a mess. It's not a mess. It's just hard to deal with, you know, because it's kinky hair. I have kinky hair. It's not that it's into weird stuff. Not that I'm not. Maybe a little. Not a lot of, you know, it's not too bad. But, you know, I guess as I am, my hair is. But it's very, you know. And even though I'm getting old, it's still pretty curly. My beard has lost a lot of its spring. So it looks longer. Used to be I never cut it. And it was still tight to my face. So now it betrays its age. It's like, well, I'm so tired of being as tight as to your face as I used to be, so I'm going to string out a little bit here. So I do trim it about once a year, maybe. Maybe twice. I'm thinking of just letting it go. Why? Because I feel like a freak again. Not that I haven't always felt like a freak, but I just feel like freaking out again. You know, that's where the word comes from, don't you? The word freaking out? It came from the concept of you'd see a friend of yours, and he'd look more or less normal. You know, he might have a John Fogerty haircut. So it's like full, you know, what people used to call kind of a beetle haircut. And say, oh, he's got long hair over the collar. Back in my school, young man, come over here. Come over here and let me see your hair. Someone hand me a ruler. That hair is too long. It's over your collar. Young man, I'm going to give you this note. If you don't get a haircut by the next time I see you, you'll be expelled. And maybe you'll get the board. For those of you who don't know, they used to beat children in school. Yes, they did. They did. Or they'd pull over a bully, and this is a God truth. They'd pull over a bully and say, teach him a lesson, would you? Don't hurt him too bad. Don't put him in the hospital, but teach him a lesson. Call him a hippie. Give him a hard time. My friend Joe, who's now a bishop, I've mentioned him, he had to go to a different school, down to Denver, south, to graduate because he got beat up so often because he grew his hair long, to the middle of his back and further, long as he could grow it. Yes, sir. Because he didn't care. And the school district said, nope, we're not going to let that happen. And so they kind of let the dogs loose, so to speak, and they beat him up every day. Yeah. That's this country at times. Maybe we're back at that. Not that it's that violent yet, but there's a lot of animosity in this country right now. It's a shame. How do we deal with that? So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with your feelings inside? I am really, over the years, have tried to train myself how to deal with other people's anger and my own anger. The Buddha was a pretty cool cat. He really was very, very smart. I do assume he existed. And the concept of the middle road, the great road, the Mahayana, you know, this idea of let's take it easy. I like that idea. But I also like the idea of sometimes I do lose my temper. But I always keep in mind that if I lose my temper at someone, that they have something over me. You know, I try not to let it bother me, but there are times when you just can't hold it back. Fear is a big one. There's a lot of fear right now. Fear and loathing, as Hunter S. Thompson put it so incredibly cleverly. A lot of people don't like HST. You know, Hunter S. Thompson. He wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That was the first piece of work I read by him. I didn't know anything about him. It was the book Hell's Angels. A friend of mine said, you've got to read this book. I read the book. I was flabbergasted. The next book I read by him was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I still have my paperback book from 1972. I had another copy. I gave it to my son. Said, here, take this. Read this. You want to understand me a little better? Here you go. It's quite a book. It captures the age. It captures the mood. I didn't do half the stuff Hunter Thompson did, but it captures the angst of the time, and I think we're back in that angst. There's a lot of angst right now. There's a lot of fear, and there's an incredible amount of loathing. How do we deal with it? How do you deal with it? For me, Hunter Thompson used to said, when the going gets tough, the tough do drugs. Well, that's not me. Not anymore. I had my day. And I did my share. You know, my fair share. But not anymore. And never again. I have seen what it can do. It can isolate a person. I was never isolated. I didn't do it that long. As soon as it became obvious that I had responsibilities in the world, in the form of a child coming into the world, that was it. Put on the put on the hip waders and said, that's it, I'm done. There are crocodiles in these here waters, I'm getting out. And that's just me. A lot of people don't feel that way, but I did. I just didn't feel that that was the right thing to do. Oh, happy Lent to all of you who practice that, and happy Ramadan to all of you who practice that. Belief. You have to believe. You don't have to believe in that or that, but you have to believe, because it's belief that keeps us, and we keep the belief. Belief is an important thing. If we don't have any beliefs, then we are going to be subject to large-scale depression and large-scale fear. Once we lose our beliefs, we begin to wither on the vine. And we might as well kind of toss in the towel. We have to believe in something, even if it's that there's nothing. I'm fine with that. Someone says to me, I don't believe in anything. And I think to myself, well, then believe in that strongly and adamantly. You know? But when it's a belief in nothing, and that belief in nothing is a form of nihilism or nihilism, depending upon how you approach the word, that's when it can become a form of just sailing into the darkness. And I don't think that's a good thing to do. You've got to fight something. You have to fight boredom. You have to fight that sense of daily ennui. You have to say to yourself, I am here because I am fighting that good fight. Not everyone does. I will never give up. I love life way too much. Life offers us experience. Life offers us joy. I mentioned my friend Bill died. And when that happened, I got on the phone and called my doctor and left a message and said, I want to review my meds, because I'm on meds. You know, most people my age are on something. And I said, I want to review my meds because I want to be here. And I talked to him yesterday and I said, I want to be around as long as possible. And he said, and I am here to support you in that. And I just loved him for that. And he was excited, you know. Because I've hemmed and hawed about a few things here and there. And he had some suggestions. And he sounded really happy to hear me talking about this. It's important. Life is important. For some reason, you and I are alive right now. Now, maybe there is no reason, but for some reason, you and I are here alive right now. And there's magic in the air. And there's magic in the moment. And we are here right now. And we mustn't forget this. And we mustn't negate it. And we mustn't undermine it. And we mustn't pretend that it's not important. It is as important as anything you can imagine. It's a lot more important than the State of the Union address that was on TV last night. Because it's ours. It's your life, and it's my life. It's ours. It's something you and I share in the moment. Now, if you're listening after the live fact, it makes no difference. It's still ours. Right? And it doesn't mean that, oh, this is, you know, Mo is speaking directly to, oh, I am speaking directly to you. But even if I'm talking to you in 100 years or 1,000 years, it's something that you and I are sharing sometime, somewhere. If you are my grandchild or my great-great-grandchild, it's important. If you're someone that I could never know, it's still important because we are alive. I was alive. You will be alive. Do you see what I'm saying? Life is the common thread. There are so many of us that take it for granted. I maybe have at times. You see, I almost died when I was 34. I almost died of double pneumonia. I had the option, but I chose to live. I had the option. Death came to me in a very pleasant form. Well, I should say in a kind of a neutral form, because I didn't feel elated to see the form of my father in a white double-breasted suit. You know, it was so trite, with an escalator in back of him and a white light at the end of it. And I even said, oh my God, that is so kind of cliche. I said, are you Dad? He said, no. But it's a form that I knew would not be afraid of. You would not be afraid of. And to hear him say that, you know, my kids would be fine. They were young. You'll be fine. The world will be fine without you. Your children will be fine without you. They'll grow up. They'll be fine. But if you want to stay, you are going to have to fight. Because you are very, very sick. And you have to stay for you. And not for any other reason. And in my dotage, it is amazing how many realizations I am having about me, about my life, about my relationships, about the truths of things that I have done and have been done to me. And it's amazing how much forgiveness I can find. Because what good is it to harbor anything else but forgiveness? So what? So what? What else matters? Why burden any of ourselves with anything but it's okay, it happened, let it go? Yeah, it'd be nice to hold a grudge and nurse it, you know, like a drink in a bar where the drinks are $40 each, you know? Wouldn't that be nice? But all it does is fester inside of us. And the only good fester is in the Addams family, let's face it. We need to deal with our joy. And there is so much joy, even in the lousiest of relationships. I can find moments that are wonderful to dwell on. Can't you? As sad as it is to say, even the crummiest relationships have moments of sheer joy in them, where you kind of look at it sheepishly and say, you know, that was pretty hot. Or, man, did we laugh. Or, I chose that. That's the one that surprises me the most. Why did I choose that? Because I was shallow. I was shallow. That comes up a fair amount. And the truth is always so lovely to embrace and to hold and to kiss on the lips, isn't it? Oh, yummy. It is. It is. And to think about the tens of thousands of times that we have lied to ourselves and trying to come up with a different reason for something we did. No, no. But ce n'est pas possible. Ce n'est pas possible. I couldn't have done that. That's my seventh grade French, I think. Which I learned just so my parents couldn't get away with talking about me. They had to really, you know, they just would look at each other. My mom's eyes would open up real wide and, you know. Maybe I was a real strange kid. I don't know. I had my moments. Maybe I'm a real strange adult. I have my moments. To me, being alive... See, when I almost died at 34, everything changed. Everything changed. I realized that life was... It wasn't the brass ring anymore on the merry-go-round. It was the ride. It was the music. I'd been holding the brass ring the entire time. It was the carousel music itself. It was going up and down on the horse. It was those crazy, scary, sneering horses. It was my kids. Oh my God, it was everything. I had to come back from a lot. A lot. I had a lot of pain ahead of me. Physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. I was coming out of my father dying. My dad, who was a hero to me, he was a mentor. Oh, he was a lovely man. God, I loved him. And I was depressed. And that had a lot to do with my illness and my not caring really at one point if I lived or died. But then I realized, for goodness sake, I so wanted to live. And every day I wake up and I realize how much I do want to live, you know? You should do something every day that reaffirms how joyous your life is. Before I came on the air, and I'm live on the air now, I love that term, I'm live on the air, because I feel alive when I talk to you. Coco Bean and I were out back throwing the ball. I'm teaching her to bring it back to me. Yesterday we did the same thing. We do it every day. Every single day, unless the weather is terrible. So we were out yesterday, and it was cold. Oh, man, was it cold. But she doesn't mind, and I don't mind, because I'm with her. And I adore her. I love her. And she loves me. So two who are in love, and she was not bringing the ball back. And I'm, you know, training with little treats, tiny little treats, you know. But she's trying to train me, too, because she's smart. She's really smart. So I held my ground yesterday. She held her ground. We had fun. We still had fun. And I, you know, kind of let her know what I want. Today, it was perfect. But we had such fun. She laughed. I laughed. Yeah, I know you're thinking, what is she laughed? You know, she laughs in her own way. And she caught the ball on a hop, which was, oh my goodness, if you could have seen her and how excited she was. She came running back to me and she jumped up and she was like, Dad, look at me, I caught the ball. And I was excited and we sat for a while and it was just, and I thought, I get to do this some more. I get the privilege of doing this some more before the biggest mystery that exists. What a privilege. What a privilege it is. You know? And there should be something in everybody's life every day, I think. And I get to do it with this wonderful, wonderful, loving, mischievous, sometimes incredibly aggravating being who chews up stuff and knows that she's doing something she shouldn't be doing. She knows it. This beautiful dog has free will and exercises it every chance she gets. She's learning. She's a teenager, you know. She's still in that teenage state in which they, you know, try to do things. God, when I was a teenager, great honk. Phew. I'm lucky to be alive, and I mean that quite seriously. My hitchhiking days, holy moly. So the people I've met in my life, ye gods. I could name names, and you'd say, you made it through that? Oh, yeah, I did. Some of the people I met, whoo-hoo. Pardon me, sip of tea here. Yeah, I met that guy. And met another guy. And lived. But the point is to say that I think that we really should feel the privilege of our time. I feel incredibly lucky to be a baby boomer because it was a strange time to grow up, you know. The 50s were unique. We were spoiled beyond comprehension. Those brand new black and white TVs, we had a Muntz, M-U-N-T-Z. I think they were probably, it was fine, you know. But we had this transition from black and white to color television. And that was like walking in space, going from being tied to the earth to suddenly walking in space, color TV. Ooh. You know, my kids grew up with color TV. It was no big deal to them. But we were just, our minds were blown by it. I remember the first time I saw Batman in color. It was unbelievable. It was like, wow, what is going on here? We were constantly amazed by things that happened in the 60s. Then we got a little older and we were constantly amazed, you know? And wow. Suddenly we were dressing differently and growing our hair long, and it was a true revelation of what it meant to be young. Because it wasn't just dressing like our parents, like Andy Hardy did, and putting on a, you know, pork pie hat and smoking a pipe like Bing Crosby, you know, like he did in the movies. That wasn't being young and driving a jalopy. No. It was saying, we are supremely different. That was my generation. And other generations that came after, we said, we're going to train you or raise you to be whomever you want to be. Do whatever you want to do. Far out, kiddos. And maybe we screwed up. I don't know. My kids seem pretty cool. I sure like them. I love them. But maybe we didn't know what we were doing any better than other generations before us. Maybe we were really selfish. But we were, you know, we were Pluto and Leo. Look at us. Look at us. With our hair and our whatever. But what we really wanted was to be children of the sun. Find ourselves. Huh. I don't know if we ever did that. Some say they did. I did. I found myself finally. I discovered who I was and what I wasn't. All you have to do is be truthful with yourself. It's all you have to do. With me, it was almost dying, and a couple other things. And the revelation that I was completely easy to take advantage of. And when I finally said to myself, well, you know what? I suppose I'm easy to take advantage of, and you know what? I guess I'm okay with that. That's all it took. That I sometimes allowed it to happen, that I knew it happened, and that it was okay with me. That's a little hard sometimes to admit in life. That sometimes we allow it to happen because we may be like the person who's doing it. That was hard to admit. I have to admit. Redundancy. I could tell stories, but not today. Not today. I don't feel like revealing that much. What a schmuck I could be. And I could be. But it's a good lesson that sometimes the truth can be extremely hard to swallow. Hard to swallow. But the older I get, the more I realize that my own truth is important. And I'm saying to you, your own truth is very important. Knowing yourself, Delphi, remember? Know thyself. Know thyself. As a matter of fact, there may be nothing more important ever, anywhere, than knowing yourself and being honest about it. That may be the most important thing there is just being honest about who you are and owning up to it and saying, yep, that's me. That's me. I know who I am, and I'm okay with that. And if you're not okay with it, then saying, well, either I need to change it or I need to accept it at some point. Right. Don't let the anger fester. Don't let it become a little white hot coal inside of you, because it will burn you up and it will hurt you. I guarantee it. I've done it. I've seen it. Instead, let there be love. Things aren't great right now. I'm not going to lie to you. Things are not great. Bad things are happening because things are changing. I don't understand the changes. Maybe in the long run, God, I hope, these people know what they're doing, but I don't think that they are taking care of a lot of people. A lot of people are losing their jobs. People with families. And maybe, I don't know, I'm not going to get into the political aspect of it other than to say that things are not, to me, things are not going well, nor are they going easily. A lot of it seems to be chaotic and haphazardly done. Chaotically done, haphazardly done. But I hold love and I hold hope in my heart. You know, that's all we can do. If we allow the anger to take over us, we can still fight with good thoughts. Right? The Dalai Lama once said something that changed my life. He said, words of anger must often be spoken, but never when angry. That is so powerful. Raising my kids changed after I read that, because I would say things to them, words of anger, but never when angry, and it chilled them to the core. You know, that creeped them out. And they would listen to me so much easier, because when you're waving your arms and flailing, it just doesn't have the effect. So we can change things. We do it calmly, with love in our hearts, and with focus. Well, that's my time for the week. As always, when I say I love you, I hope you know I mean it, because I do. Until next week, I'm wishing you all peace and love. Later.
Until next we meet, I'll be waiting for you right here in the Paisley Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Penny Paisley Penny Arcade. My name is Mo Abdelbaki, and Happy New Year. Welcome to 2025. And oh boy, howdy, as it started off interestingly enough. No kidding, huh? How you doing? This is the first show of 2025. Today is the 8th of January. 1-2 Radio is back on the air. And along with it, c'est moi. That means I'm back. It does not. Those of you who speak French, you know that. And do I speak French? Well, I've been known to. Not very well, I must admit. Or admois. That's not... Oh, God. I took French for 9 years total. 9 years of my life. And that's all I have to show for it. I took it through junior high, high school, and some college. And I know a few things. My mom spoke it quite fluently. But then she went to a French Catholic school in Alexandria, Egypt. And her sister actually went to that same school and ended up teaching there. So they spoke parlez-vous, you know. I'm kidding. I'm a little better than that. But I like French. I've always thought it might be nice to live in France, you know. I always wanted to go to Paris, and I always thought it'd be nice to actually, you know, live in Paris and maybe in the French countryside around Brittany. I always thought Brittany might be a nice place. I don't know why. I mean, I have no idea why, you know. And I always thought if you just kind of went, ha, 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 you know, that'd be good enough. Robert Benchley, the American humorist, actually wrote a hilarious, I think, hilarious article on French. And it might be worth your while if you're into that sort of thing from the past.